obviously, the most depressing part of the time that we're in is that we're going to have to build up a shared sense of values again, because there has been so much permission given to live a life of pure grievance and no gratitude. I think that my biggest challenge has always been gratitude, realizing that my luck is just astonishing in every way. And I should wake up every day with that being the first thought in my mind and the last thought when I go to sleep at night. But of course, you know, I'll grouse.
Hello. On this episode of Shelf Life, the journalist and host of On the Media, Brooke Gladstone, on finding her calling, life in Moscow, and what her love for the madcap Russian classic, The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, can tell us today. Coming up after the break.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. Leaders in Iran are warning of a harsh response of the U.S. and Israel attack Iran over the protests that have engulfed the country over the past 2 weeks. Iranian security forces are cracking down. Human rights groups say that more than 100 people have been killed, thousands others detained. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
Iran's parliament speaker said Tehran would consider U.S. military facilities and Israel legitimate targets for preemptive strikes if there are signs by either country of an imminent attack. Iran's military was badly weakened after the 12-day war with Israel last June. President Trump has warned the U.S. will hit hard if Iran kills protesters. He reiterated that in a social media post Saturday evening, saying the U.S. stands ready to help. The protests that began at the end of December over the economy have quickly spread to all corners of Iran, with people shouting death to the dictator, meaning Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Minnesota officials are urging protesters to remain peaceful as more demonstrations are expected to protest the deadly shooting of 37-year-old Renee Good by an ICE agent. The protesters are also following the shooting of two people in Portland by federal officials. NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran explains.
The federal investigation into the shooting of Renee Good is ongoing. The FBI took over the case, keeping state investigators from accessing evidence. State and local authorities are not happy about that, and they're now asking the public for help, collecting their own evidence. Meanwhile, all eyes are in Minneapolis. The Trump administration has promised to continue its immigration crackdown in the state. More federal agents could arrive in Minnesota in the next few days. This probably means more protests. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has also said he's ready to deploy the state's National Guard if needed. All of this as the community continues to mourn the killing of Renee Good.
The Trump administration says it's freezing all USDA funding to Minnesota, including SNAP food aid. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on the reasons why.
Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins announced the funding freeze in a letter posted on X, claiming the Trump administration has uncovered massive fraud in Minnesota. It's not clear what she meant by that, but the letter noted the years-long benefits fraud scandal there that's already seen more than 60 people convicted. USDA is demanding justification before it restarts payments, $129 million in all. The move comes as a judge has temporarily blocked a much larger funding freeze, $10 billion in cash aid, child care, and other social services to Minnesota and four other Democratic-led states. The Trump administration has alleged rampant fraud in all those states without providing evidence. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. China says it opposes what it terms Somaliland's collusion with Taiwan as authorities seek its independence. As Michael Koloki reports, the statement follows Israel's decision to formally recognize the self-declared Republic of Somaliland as an independent state.
Somalia has condemned Israel's move, claiming that Somaliland is an inseparable part of Somalia. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, who is on a tour of several African countries, said today that China supports Somalia in safeguarding its sovereignty. Yi added that Beijing opposed what he claimed as Somaliland's collusion with Taiwan authorities to seek independence. Authorities in Taiwan, a self-governed democracy of about 24 million people that is claimed by China, are reported to have welcomed Israel's recognition of Somaliland. For NPR News, I'm Michael Koloki in Nairobi.
The Washington National Opera is now the latest arts organization that says it will cut ties to the Kennedy Center as a result of President Trump assuming control over the center's governing board and adding his name recently to the facility. The opera has been based at the Kennedy Center for more than 50 years. In a statement to NPR, the opera said it made the decision to end the relationship because the center's new policies are causing strain on its financial model. However, the decision was announced by the Kennedy Center's leadership, and it now says it made the decision to sever names with the opera. Numerous arts organizations are also cutting ties. I'm Dan Ronan, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
Obviously, the most depressing part of the time that we're in is that we're going to have to build up a shared sense of values again, because there has been so much permission given to live a life of pure grievance and no gratitude. I think that my biggest challenge has always been gratitude, realizing that my luck is just astonishing in every way. And I should wake up every day with that being the first thought in my mind and the last thought when I go to sleep at night. But of course, you know, I'll grouse.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. It's Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest for this episode is the journalist and radio host, Brooke Gladstone. For 22 years, she has been demystifying the media for listeners of her indispensable public radio show, On the Media. The press is also the subject of her acclaimed book, The Influencing Machine. But her long career, which began in summer stock theatre, has also included stints as editor at NPR's Weekend Edition and All Things Considered, as well as a three-year posting to Moscow as a correspondent for NPR. We'll get to see just how her knowledge of Russian history and language helps her appreciate the book she has chosen to talk about today, the classic Russian novel, The Master and Margarita, by Mikhail Bulgakov, in which the story of Jesus and Pontius Pilate is juxtaposed with the story of the devil wreaking havoc in 1930s Moscow. Brooke, welcome to Shelf Life.
Such a pleasure to be here, Aaron.
We're recording this at the end of 2022. We'll go out shortly after the new year. Standing here on the precipice of 2023, as someone who has, through your show, talked about, analyzed everything from 9/11 to the financial crash of 2008 to various wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, now Ukraine, I wonder how you currently feel about the future, optimistic or pessimistic?
I've always believed in taking a sort of 10,000-mile view of things, because if you look at things in geological terms, it's really not that bad. But in terms of how optimistic do I feel, I think we understand who we are with the passing of each dreadful year. And I know that in historical terms, these years are not that dreadful. They're not nearly as violent as years in the past. They're not as pestilent as years in the past, even with COVID-19. They're not as unfair as the years of the past collectively, although we have more anger, more inequality, and more pestilence at the moment than some of us had as we were growing up, depending on how old we are. So, in the words of Douglas Adams, everything that you've experienced up until the age of 35 seems normal and as it should be, and everything that happens after that seems bizarre and peculiar and unnatural, whether it's devices of all kinds and modes of communication, or the state of the politics of the world.
You've said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that the media, the news industry, the press does depend on bad news. Like it's what makes the media tick. We need to tell the bad stories. Do you feel, after 22 years at On the Media, that telling a few more of the good stories would put us all in a better mood, better stead?
I think it would help, but there is a problem, and that is engagement. We are more engaged by the notion of danger and the need to protect than we are by joy and happiness. I mean, I've always said that, for instance, I have two kids, that it's much easier to express the exhaustion and frustrations of parenthood than it is to express the joys. There's just no words for that, in a way. I think that it isn't so much about good news as it is about demonstrating agency, that we aren't helpless, that we do have the power to make things better. And those are the sorts of good stories, I think, that are profoundly needed now, because we can and we do, but it's underreported. And I think we could do so much more if we understood what was possible.
I'm going to take you back to your formative years in Long Island. I want to get a sense of the young Brooke Gladstone. How would you describe that childhood?
Well, it was the quintessential suburb, and I found it bone-crunchingly tedious. Couldn't wait to get out of there. You know, I can't describe the glory of running through the woods. I do remember walking around at Christmas time, looking at all the lights and all the windows and thinking this was the magic time in the suburbs. You'd walk down the block and it was an absolutely celestial garden. But most of the time, you couldn't get anywhere far without driving. So mostly we'd run through each other's backyards. I had a playhouse in the backyard and we used to put on plays and pretend that we lived there, and some of them for the neighbors and some of them just for ourselves. You know, everyone's time when they're a kid is a time of imagination. I have a lot of siblings. I mean, I'm the third of six.
Oh, wow.
Actually, I'm now the third of five because one of my younger sisters died in October.
I'm sorry.
But this is a strange period. You haven't gotten here yet, Aaron. When you get into your mid to late 60s, you feel like you're running in traffic with all your co-generationalists. You see someone nicked by a car on the side, or someone goes under the wheels of a truck, someone's thrown, and you just keep looking right and left and maybe grab a glimpse behind you and ahead, and you just wonder, it seems so random in a way. And you do find yourself appreciating the friends you've had for so long and the people who have shared the world as you have known it. You know, the world changes all the time. I think that's a good thing. I'm not one of those get off my lawn people who feel that the world has to be preserved in amber. But, you know, places you've lived for years can be places you no longer recognize. Mm-hmm. Boy, I've really wandered off your question there. Can you even remember what it was?
No, you've wandered in a very profound way. I know you have said elsewhere that your parents did not live long lives. And I wonder if that makes you feel your mortality at this point in life more than you might otherwise.
Well, hard to know what it would be otherwise. You know, someone once asked me, what's it like to have twins? And, you know, I don't know what it's like not to have twins. So I don't know how to compare it since I've only had one set of twins. My parents didn't die tragically young. They just didn't wear that well. They were perpetually 17. They made endless numbers of imprudent decisions, like having 6 kids, for instance. They went bankrupt a lot and ended up in Mexico, living on Social Security very happily. They died around the age of 70, which isn't that far from where I am now. Is it just natural to think that somehow how long your parents live is some referent on how long you're going to live? I don't know. Even long before my parents died, I've always been very conscious of my mortality. I used to say that I started wearing black when I was 13 to commemorate the passing of my childhood. I have worn it most days. I think there are just some people who are sort of conscious of the train out there eventually going to be pulling into the station, and others who aren't. And I can't say which is better or wiser. Just I'm the former.
Sticking with the celestial garden of Long Island in your youth, I'm curious about these plays you put on with your siblings, I'm presuming, or siblings and friends. What were the plays? Did you write and direct them? Were you the star of them?
We did put on our own versions of things like Mary Poppins and stuff like that. But mostly what we did were we would repeat these sort of improvisational set pieces. Especially in the basement, we pretended that we were all orphans and that elves left us things to, you know, what's that? You know, it's a shoe or something like that. The fork, you comb through your hair and so forth. That it was just some sort of nameless, featureless place in which we had just been left and we had to sort of find our way with the clues that were left there. In the basement, there were always lots of different clues because being of a certain age, my father stocked the basement with canned goods and huge gallon jugs of water just in case the bomb dropped. this is all, I was born in 55, so that can give you a cultural reference there.
Was it a bookish family?
Was it a bookish family? Actually, my mother was a huge reader, and we had books of all sorts. We had collections, you know, bound in leather of like George Eliot and Shakespeare. And then she had all kinds of novels. And I remember that on the bookshelf, it's not a bookshelf, it was the kind of bed that at the end of it, there was kind of a little shelf just a little above the headboard. And I remember I wandered in there once when I was 11 and picked up a copy that I saw there called The Tropic of Cancer, and I was scandalized. But I did read quite a lot of it.
A young age for such an earthy education, Brooke. You told another podcast, Long Form, that you got fired from 5 waitressing jobs in D.C.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I'd just love to get a sense of what it would have been like to be served in a restaurant by Brooke Gladstone.
Well, I would walk over. Now, this was in 1978 in what was then a rather, it was sort of like the, you know, the East Village of the 80s in Washington, D.C., a neighborhood called Adams Morgan, which of course is all cleaned up like the East Village pretty much is now. And I was a bar waitress, and people were so rude in that period. This is one of those places where there was an outdoor cafe and there was a wooden floor and they had sawdust on it and they'd sweep it out every night because otherwise your feet would completely stick to the floor. And people would grab your dress or they'd scream at you for the sales tax. And, you know, I would sometimes be very nice. I sometimes dated customers, but more often I would become very angry. I was very quick to rage in those days. So I would sometimes tear up their order before I brought it to the kitchen and just let them sit there for a while until they realized nothing was coming. Sometimes I pretended that I couldn't speak English. That was always fun. I was a theater student after all. But, you know, I did end up marrying one of the customers. So there you go. At the time, they thought I just hated men and that I was impossible. So they fired me.
You're listening to Shelf Life with me, Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Brooke Gladstone, the journalist and host of the public radio show On the Media. Brooke, you mentioned there that you were studying theatre while waitressing in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
What was the draw of theatre and what ultimately dissuaded you from pursuing an acting career?
Oh, well, who isn't drawn by theatre? Especially if you come from a house full of six kids all clamoring for attention. We were all, at least most of us, more than half of us were theatery people. And my father, in his retirement years, played many roles. Horace Vandegelder from Hello, Dolly. Famously, of course, Tevye in in Fiddler on the Roof. And many others. I loved to sing. I still do. And I loved the rush of being in front of an audience. I always felt such goodwill from an audience. But I have a family trait, which is an essential tremor, which I didn't know what that was at the time. All I knew was that a little bit of stress could set it off to the point where it looked like I was having a seizure, which definitely interfered with auditions because I didn't sense anywhere near the kind of goodwill from the auditioners that I felt from the audience. Never had an episode in front of an audience ever in my entire life. But in front of the auditioners, back before I realized there was such a thing called propranolol, which is a beta blocker, I just realized I wasn't going to be able to pull that off. And so I moved crab-wise into the career I have now.
I was going to say that most of those listening will, of course, know you best as the host of On the Media. It's an incredibly rigorous, tightly edited, always interesting show. But for me, a big part of its appeal, and I think it might well be a legacy of your early theatrical career, is your delivery, your voicing. I mean, people take these things for granted, audiences, but you surely know that takes work. Your voicing just has tremendous warmth and enthusiasm and invites us into the program. Is that something you're aware of? You're laughing.
But... Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely am. And when I've trained other people, I've said, if you don't care about what you're doing, then no one else is going to care about it. You're cueing them that there's nothing more intimate than a human voice. Mm. And the medium of radio is very unlike any other medium, because of that sense of a one-to-one relationship that you don't get with television. And, you know, you don't get, at least from the news media in print. The point is to guide people through things, through that voice. It feels as close as a breath on your cheek. Mm-hmm. And the audio equivalent of a raised eyebrow can be very, very powerful. And the hardest part of the job is sincerely ginning myself up to care about things that I may have covered many times before. That's the struggle, because I know that people can sense when you're not being sincere. So I have to be sincere. I have to find something in a story that I really do care about. And I have to make clear that the stakes are that it isn't just an interesting story, that it's an interesting story that can have an impact on our lives or can teach us something about ourselves. And so that's how we choose the stories. And that's why I'm able to put that in my voice, because that work is being done in my head, not with my pipes. I've got a pretty nasal voice. In fact, as time has gone on, when I was a reporter for National Public Radio, I will do this for you now. I lifted the soft palate at the back of my mouth, which is where the air comes through. When I was filling in for Scott, I'd say, from National Public Radio in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. Scott is out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And you can hear a pleasant roundness to the tone. As I got my own chair, it took me a while to allow the Long Island narrowing of the airstream. I think I decided to do it once. And when my kids were pissing me off and they were upstairs, and I said, "Sophie, Maxine, come down here right now." And they went, "Not if you're using your radio voice. We're not coming down if you're using your radio voice." And so then, as time went on, the soft palate got lower and lower and lower until it became what is now my real voice, which is what I use on the radio. And that makes it easier to be authentic because you're actually authentic.
You mentioned working on Weekend Edition as an editor for Scott Simon. You started at NPR in your early 30s. I think you were 32 or 33.
Yeah, 32.
What was the jump from Summer Stock Theater in your early 20s to NPR in your early 30s?
Well, it wasn't a jump. It was like more of a crawl. I had to do something with my life when I realized I wasn't going to be performing. So I was in D.C. and I was doing trade journalism. The first job I had was as a reporter for a trade magazine for the strip mining industry, the Mining and Reclamation Council, from which I was fired after about a year because, well, I don't know exactly why, but I do know that it happened shortly after I suggested that we do a series on acid rain. And very shortly after that, they said I didn't fit into the culture and I was gone. Then I got this job for a public broadcasting trade paper called Current, which came out a couple of times a month, and it was small, and it was just basically two of us. And that's where I learned how to be a reporter. Mm. And it was during an NPR crisis of bad management where they'd misplaced or misspent $18 million. And there was an oversight committee investigation on the Hill. And Frank Mankiewicz was fired. And I was doing a lot of coverage for my little newsletter, which suddenly became very important. And NPR had to cover it. So they brought in a reporter from Chicago who was Scott Simon. And I got to meet him covering the same events at this NPR crisis. And then when that was over, 5 years later, I was working for something called the Washington Weekly, which only lasted for a year. And my husband bumped into Scott at the Smithsonian, where Dizzy Gillespie was donating a trumpet. And he said, "You know, I have this new show and my editor has to be a couple of months in L.A. And is Brooke free?" And then I went and got that job and did not leave it.
So you end up in Moscow as NPR's correspondent. It's a very turbulent time. This is the era of, I think, of the coup, the sort of post-perestroika era, glasnost era.
Right.
Tell me about that experience.
I had gotten a night fellowship, so we were able to spend a year in Stanford studying the language. We arrived in Moscow just about a year after Yeltsin had ridden in on the tanks and the Soviet Union had fallen. It was an extraordinary time. Of course, I was carrying with me all kinds of Cold War notions of what Moscow would be like. I'd never been there before. And yet, in some ways, it didn't feel like a real city to me because New York was the city. So people standing on the corners, guiding traffic and stuff, it all felt like a toy city to me, even though Moscow is immense. But it was so strange. It was very in your face initially, very rich. Everyone spoke with such passion. Everyone's emotions were so much on the surface. Oh, it was a great place to get tape, Aaron. I mean, people were eloquent in their rage, confusion, hope for the future in some rare cases. What I realized later is that what I thought was wonderful news didn't matter too much to the Muscovites and to the Russians. And what I thought was concerning also didn't matter much to them. What mattered to them was stability. Mm. I saw huge inflation. You know, professors putting their books out on blankets on the street to sell them. I saw a lot of anger. The attack on the Russian White House, their parliament building, was extraordinary. That's the closest I've ever come to being in a almost wartime situation. There was a sniper fire hitting the buildings above my head when I was up against the walls of the Duma. It was thrilling, and it was, how do I put it? It changed my life. I think everybody should live somewhere very, very foreign for an extended period of time to better understand your own life, mm-hmm. your own country, and to be able to explain it to others. That is the tremendous joy and privilege of being a reporter, being to ask impertinent questions under the cover of doing your job, and being forced to make sense of it before you put it out there for somebody else to take a lesson from or to just learn from.
And where were you living when you were in Moscow? What was your home like there?
I was living in an apartment in the north of Moscow at the end of the Black Line at a place called Kralatskoye, where there were a lot of foreigners. It wasn't the American Reporter Circle, which was in a place called Sadovaya Samotochnaya, which was much more central. I had to get on the subway and ride for about 25 minutes to get where I was going to go. So there were lots of North Koreans, and there were Canadians and Australians and Americans and French and German. They were all in these very cement block kind of houses that were built maybe 10, 15 years earlier, but were already beginning to show their age. Plain floors, plain white walls, but the elevators worked. And after we left, the reporter who took the apartment after us had the place swept for bugs, and there were 40 of them.
Wow. I was about to say this was a period of relative press freedom, but I guess not.
You know what? I think that this building had been built before Perestroika was in full throttle. And I think when you were building for foreigners, you'd just put tons of bugs in there. Honestly, during the Yeltsin period, I don't think anybody listened. There was way too much chaos.
Brooke, we'll be talking more about Moscow when we talk about your book choice for this episode. I want to talk about your book first, The Influencing Machine, originally published mm-hmm. in 2011, but reissued in a 10th anniversary edition in 2021. You tackled mm-hmm. many questions about the history of the media, but among them was one I think quite pertinent to this show: is the internet destroying our capacity to concentrate? An obvious question related to that: do you read more novels now or fewer than you used to?
You know, here's the thing. Is it because of the internet, or is it because I'm just older? And when I do the show, I'm so tired that digging into I'm a science fiction freak mostly. And there are certainly elements of that in The Master and Margarita, which we'll discuss, and in, many of the other books that I might mention. So I do read tons of those, but they are of varying quality. Sometimes they are absolutely brilliant, and sometimes they're just, something you down like a box of bonbons. So I still read novels, but lately, when the show is hard, I don't have a lot of headspace left. And I've hardly gone on the internet at all, except for a certain amount of OCD engagement with the New York Times games. I'm not on there that much. This is a twitchy time, a time when it's hard to settle down into a great novel. But I was very grateful to take up The Master and Margarita again. The Influencing Machine initially argued that we are better in some ways and worse in others than we were before, but that mankind has always been shaped by its tools. And so Socrates was not a fan of writing because it interfered with your memory. Others were against novels because of their corrupting effect on young women. Same thing with the radio. Don't let your daughter read too much. I mean, every single technology came with many warning labels. And so I'm skeptical of the warning labels that back in 2011 were attached to the internet. But in the second edition, I modulated my perspective quite a lot. In fact, I sort of flipped around on the entire organizing principle of the book in the final chapter because I got to see things play out. I got to see the technology develop in a way that made it so much more powerfully manipulative. And I also changed my view, Aaron, a little bit of human nature. Mm-hmm. I used to blame us for our media, that human nature, you know, will choose what it does. The heart knows what it wants. And so if our media are debased, it's because we want to follow it down that road or we want to lead it down that road. Now I realize, or I believe something very different, which is that our natures are plastic and we are capable of being our best selves or our worst selves. Mm. And the media can manipulate us for profit, for clicks, can undermine our effort to find answers by filling the screens with boxes and flashing lights rather than respecting our wish to learn something and simply confine itself to that. It is a technology that up until this point has not encouraged the development of our better selves, but our most profitable selves, which are angry and engaged and will encourage clicks that make other people angry, and those clicks will put us in front of ads. So I realized that our plastic natures have been manipulated to be less than we can be, and that we might be if the media were designed to truly serve us and respect our humanity. So now no one has to buy the book.
On that note, you are a public figure who does not spend a huge amount of time posting on Twitter.
You've noticed that, right?
I thought that was very refreshing. Is that deliberate or are you just not interested?
I've tried because, you know, it's good for the show to have a presence and it's good for me as a public figure to develop that kind of presence. But, you know, I have no more. This show is on the radio, right? So I can't really use the F word. I have no more Fs to give. I have no interest in negotiating or climbing up the bloodstained rungs of the public radio or any other hierarchy now. I'm focused now on time and satisfying my curiosity and seeing if I can do this one thing that I do well better. I don't get much out of those Twitter conversations. I love hearing about what's going on from Fred. But for me, it's a time sink and I'd rather do something else. I left Facebook a long, long time ago. I think Facebook is really terrible.
You won't get any argument from me on that one, Brooke. I'm talking with Brooke Gladstone about her book, The Influencing Machine, her long career at NPR with WNYC's On the Media, and why she is satisfying her curiosity by harnessing her skills as a journalist rather than wasting her time on Twitter and Facebook. Stay with us after the break for some book talk on The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov.
NPR Music is looking for the next great undiscovered musician to play the tiny desk. If you're an unsigned artist, record a video of yourself playing one original song behind a desk and submit it to the 11th annual Tiny Desk Contest by February 9th. And if you win, you'll play your very own Tiny Desk concert. Think you've got what it takes?
Learn more at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the American invasion of Venezuela. I'll talk with the author of How to Hide an Empire about the seizure of Nicolas Maduro, American imperialism, oil, and Donald Trump's view of power. Historian Daniel Immerwahr joins me next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen tonight at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the journalist and host of On the Media, Brooke Gladstone. We're talking about one of her favorite books, The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. Brooke, apparently you and Daniel Radcliffe and the 11th Doctor Who, Matt Smith, all consider The Master and Margarita as one of the greatest novels ever written. Bulgakov himself, of course, never lived to see it published. He died in 1940, when I think it would have been inconceivable for such a book to see the light of day. It came out several decades later in the late 60s, first in a Moscow magazine and then as the novel we know today. It's chaotic, energetic, explosive, inventive. It's honestly not quite like any other novel I've read, and it's certainly not like any other Russian novel. It contains three separate storylines that intertwine. The first and most memorable for me is the sort of slapstick depiction of life in Stalinist Moscow, seen in part through the antics of the devil Woland and his cohorts, including a walking cat.
Entourage.
Entourage. There's this much more straightforward story of Pontius Pilate and Jesus. And finally, the story of the Master and Margarita of the title, a writer and his lover. And it all takes place in a super compressed timeline, a matter of days, really. When did you first read this rather astonishing book?
I read it in college when I took a course in Russian literature, many decades before any of the other people you've mentioned. Although I'm very glad to see it's getting its due. I have very strong feelings about the book, and I also have very strong feelings about the translation, of which I have read several. Ooh. And if you put this on your shelves, I would like you to choose a particular translation. Are you ready?
I'm on tenterhooks, Brooke, which is the translation I should have been reading all along and instead of this one.
Diana Bergen and Catherine Tiernan O'Connor. The one that I'd read in college was the Mira Ginsburg version, which is brilliant, but it was many years until I realized that it was fundamentally incomplete because it was drawn from Moscow magazine. It was originally serialized during a period of thaw. It was still substantially cut by editors. I didn't get a feeling of expurgation from it when I read it in college, and that was the only one that was available. And to this day, I love the spirit of the Mira Ginsburg novels. Some of the ones that followed, there's one by Misha Glenny, which I found a bit stolid, not loony enough. And then there was one by a husband and wife team. He's a writer, she's a Russian, and that was celebrated, but I also found that a bit limp as well. The one that came closest in spirit to Mira Ginsburg's and was also absolutely complete, it is the one by Diana Bergen and Catherine Tiernan O'Connor. Which one have you been reading?
That's not the version I've been reading. I've been reading the translation by Richard Pevier and Larissa Volonsky.
The husband and wife team.
Husband and wife team, famously translated Tolstoy. But yeah, now I understand that none of these others were quite loopy enough.
Well, it's also, for those who have compared, it is truly complete. So there are references that have been skimmed off in other versions, even references to the devil. And I just think you'll get closest to Bulgakov's perspective on Moscow at the time. And if you know about Bulgakov and Stalin. Stalin toyed with him endlessly. You know, he wrote plays, Stalin would close them down. Stalin would lean in and scare him and then walk away and say, go ahead and write. And it was like a cat playing with a mouse. It was really a kind of devastating, spirit-crushing game. But the effervescence, the joy, the darkness, the lunacy of The Master and Margarita, written between, I think it was 29 and 1940, actually, and sat in a drawer. And it was his beloved wife who got it out there. And his description of Margarita with her short, dark hair is not unlike that of his wife. From what I've read, there was a tremendous intimacy between the two. And when I lived in Moscow, we hired an expert to take us on a Gilligan-like three-hour tour of The Master and Margarita's Moscow, because there are lots of addresses in his novel. You could look through and see where their apartment was supposed to be. And then there are other tributes. There are bars that are tributes to The Master and Margarita. We once went up a hallway that was nothing but the most glorious graffiti related to The Master and Margarita. Why does it inspire? It's a tremendously moving book, especially when you get the whole book. It is a book about politics that does not serve the people. People have described it as a combination of Faust and maybe Kafka. Mm. But the two of those only tell part of the story. You really have to throw in, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez and other kinds of magic realism that imbues things with a kind of wonder and a hilarity that is akin to joy.
I wonder if you've considered whether a novel like this can be treated as a form of journalism, just in terms of the sort of social and political climate it manages to describe.
In a way that every novel does, if it is a novel about the consequences of politics, which this one was. This was a satire. This was a parody of Stalin's Russia, down to the finest detail of the ministries and the small-time corruption. I do want to say one thing, though, that when I read it again just this weekend, after not having picked it up for 15 years, I found something that made me uncomfortable in Bulgakov's writing, which is the first time I ever noticed it, which says a lot about me. And that is, in the description of Satan's ball, the servants are all black. And at one point, a jazz band becomes all monkeys and gorillas. It made me very uncomfortable. And it felt like one of those situations where you love a writer, but he's, you know, very unenlightened. It wasn't hateful. It was just a thing he did. Dickens in earlier books was really anti-Semitic and did his best to expiate in a novel he wrote called Our Mutual Friend. I love the poems of T.S. Eliot. Didn't love the anti-Semitism. The racism that I see in so many books can disqualify them. But just as I haven't disqualified writers for holding unfortunate views in an unenlightened time, I wouldn't want to scare people away from the joys and the unalloyed pleasures of Master and Margarita. That will, I think, take people aback if they notice it, as I did. I'm in the business of noticing those things now, have been for the last couple of decades. And I think that Bulgakov may have rarely seen a black person in his time in Russia.
The book opens with a bang on a hot spring evening at the Patriarch's Ponds in Moscow, where Woland meets two Russian writers, Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz and a poet who goes by the name of Homeless. The chapter is titled Never Talk with Strangers for very good reason. A short while later, Berlioz is decapitated by a tram. And then the hijinks really, really begin.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that Misha Glenny's version, translation, was not loony enough. This book is full of lunatic scenes. Which was your favorite?
Oh, wow. Well, obviously, after the magic act at the Variety Theater, the consequences keep rolling out from that over and over and over. But I found this time I took particular delight in how two of the entourage, Behemoth and Kororiev, ended up setting fire to every place they went, including burning down the special writer's restaurant, Griboyedev, where there are lots of perks. And because I know what Bulgakov was basing those places on, I enjoyed a kind of vicarious schadenfreude in watching it go up in smoke.
Yeah, some of that is Mikhail Bulgakov's critique, really, of the way that when this novel was being written, certainly literature was controlled by the state through the writer's union, which is very much parodied in the novel by this organization called Massolit. It was often interesting to me to sort of figure out whether Bulgakov was attacking Stalinism or attacking his peers, his fellow writers who had compromised with Stalinism.
Yeah, both. I mean, it's the corrupting impact on society, the compliance and hypocrisy of those who benefited from being directed by the state in what they would choose to write. The scene opens with Berlioz telling Bezdomny, that is Homeless, the poet, whose name was based on the kinds of names that were given to a lot of the poets of the day, like Gorky and others, about how he should write about religion. He was basically telling him that his critique of Christianity was giving Christianity too much credit as a thing, and he ought to cut away the idea that such a thing even exists, and he just wasn't doing it enough. Did you find it moving? I found it deeply moving at the end. The story of Pilate and the story of the master and of Homeless. There are a few people who escape the savagery of Bulgakov. Very few. He takes very few prisoners in this book. There are a few people who are innocent, and some of them suffer and some of them don't, just as in real life. Actually, they all suffer a bit, some fatally and some not. And then there are some rather evil people or really venal people who do just well.
Brooke, revisiting The Master and the Margarita now, especially in the wake of what's been happening in the United States in the last 4 or 5 years, do you read it at all differently? Do you see any parallels with some of our current political condition or recent political condition?
In one way, I suppose, the ease of which people in power lie and people who are out of power lie. There are very few people who are genuine in this book. It is a very Russian book in that for most of Russia's history, and certainly now, people had a face that they kept private for drinking at the table. It was called za stolom, at the table. And the face they showed to the outside world, the beliefs they expressed to their intimate circle, and the one that they presented to the world. You think that we all do that, but not to the degree that the Russians did under Stalin and Brezhnev and so on. This sense that you don't do yourself any favors by pushing against the project. And so you are two people effectively all the time. I think that the way this book echoes American politics, or where I can find those echoes, are in the role of outward lies and self-deception, which powers so much of the savage comedy. We have seen people who just lie with a straight face all the time, lie when lying isn't even necessary, won't even work to your advantage, just for the hell of it. There's so much of that in this book. Self-deception, a sense of rectitude where there is absolutely demonstrably none. And I think that may be where the echoes are for me. But it is very Muscovite. It is about a place that is ruled by a totalitarian idea. America is a place full of dissent. And so there is a fundamental difference in that. Bureaucracies, though, are incredibly frustrating wherever you go. But this is about a place that refuses to believe in God and refuses to believe in the devil. And so they make themselves very readily the most willing victims to the hilarious depredations of Satan and his pals.
That's wonderfully put. Master and Margarita is reportedly still one of the most popular novels in Russia. Why do you think that is? Or why do you think the readers of it in Russia today don't see, if indeed they don't see, the parallels with Putin?
They probably do, but it's just a rollicking great story. Who are the readers in Russia? Who are the readers anywhere? You know, they are generally an educated class. There are dissenters. Whether you are a farmer or you are a college professor, if you are a reader, then you're curious and your mind is open and you want to be engaged with this form. Readers are a self-selecting audience. There are a lot of readers in Russia, and they would be like any other reader, whether you're, you know, me or Daniel Radcliffe or Matt Smith, eager to be engaged by something that is a pure delight.
Brooke, you've obviously read many translations of The Master of Margarita. How many times have you read the book in total, would you estimate?
I would say that I've read it about, well, at least a half a dozen times, but not for at least 15 years until now. I've picked it up and read parts of it, but I haven't dug into the whole thing, except in preparation for this interview. And except for that one discordant note during Satan's Ball, I thought it was every bit as magnificent as I had when I read it the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth times.
Brooke, it's been such a pleasure talking to you about The Master of Margarita and your long and splendid career as a journalist and host of On the Media.
I'm glad we had a chance to finally do this, Aaron. Thank you.
We've been talking about The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, published by Penguin Random House. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Maritz, and sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like this show, you can find plenty more on Apple, Spotify, and shelflifepodcast.net with guests such as Michael Cunningham, Lydia Millett, Douglas Stewart, and Jonathan Escoffrey. While you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating? It can help others find us.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law helps keep our kids safe. Paid for by Catholic Charities.
What makes some people act courageously in a scary or dangerous moment? Are they less afraid than the rest of us?
You can never eliminate fear. I can't tame it to zero. So I had to cross that chasm from shame to tame to really